From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Baltimore City Public Schools filled some key vacancies this week. We look at the hiring left to do, at how Frederick Douglass High near Mondawmin Mall is moving forward, and at plans to support teachers after this challenging summer. Then, a former immigrant rights organizer in Seattle, the son of Indian parents, Hari Kondabolu, is a very hot stand-up comic. He's bringing his barbs about race and ethnicity to the Creative Alliance next week and joins Tom Hall for a preview. Plus, is Baltimore overrun with stray cats? Nathan speaks to Jennifer Browse of the Baltimore Animal Rescue and Care Shelter about giving homes to adoptable stray cats while preventing the births of thousands of feral ones. And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler, First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, it's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Schools are gearing up to reopen soon. In city schools, the closing months of the spring semester were punctuated by the clash between students and Baltimore police at Mondawmin Mall the day of Freddie Gray's funeral, and the surge in shootings that has followed, sparking classroom conversations about policing, crime, poverty, and justice. All that, along with reports of vacancies in top posts and teaching positions at public schools, have us thinking about what students will experience as they head back to class in coming weeks. With us to talk about how the school year is shaping up for students, teachers, and administrators is Erica Green, education reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Lisa Grillo, Chief of Human Capital at Baltimore City Public Schools. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Erica, Gilmore Elementary in Sandtown, the school in Freddie Gray's neighborhood, lost its principal in June and just got a new one this week. Who will now lead Gilmore Elementary?
Curtis Durham will lead Gilmore Elementary. He was appointed on Tuesday. He comes from another middle school, I believe is Cross Country Elementary Middle School. I don't know much more about him other than that. But that, you know, is who is going to be leading that school.
Dr. Grillo, what other key staffing changes were announced by the school board Tuesday night?
We had six principals that were named into positions, one of which was Kelvin Bridgers, who is the new principal of Frederick Douglass High School. We conducted a national search for that position and found one of our own who emerged as the top candidate and who the entire school community and the CEO and CAO has great deal of excitement about him and really feel like he was absolutely the best candidate for that position.
And of course, Frederick Douglass is the high school right close to Mondawmin Mall that was so much in the public eye at the time of the riot. Erica, overall, is the situation this year with teacher and principal vacancies just before the school opens, is this pretty typical?
It is pretty typical. it's, you know, in previous years, the number has reached around 200. Last year, with 1 week to go, there were 190. This year, with 2 weeks before at least teachers report, it was around 240 openings. I know that the school system said that it had offered, you know, 80 jobs in one day. And across the state, teacher vacancy numbers are always fluid. It's also a national trend. There have been, you know, stories in the front of the New York Times and in the Washington Post about teacher vacancies. But, you know, as far as the city goes, it is pretty typical. But every year, it's still a concern that that number of vacancies are running up against such a time frame for when students are due to go back to school.
You spoke with the principal who left Gilmore School in Sandtown, Mark Bongiovanni. Briefly, what did he tell you for why he left?
He told me in June, right around his resignation time, that he basically felt you know, not supported by the current administration. He said that it was his first year on the job. He opened with a number of vacancies. The school had obviously been through a lot, and they had some issues like attendance. He definitely fessed up to that. But in the end, he said what put him over the edge was when he was told that he wasn't a good fit. With really no supporting evidence of that. He said that he was told that, an administrator had conducted some secret observations in his school and found that he wasn't running a tight ship, that he told to lawmakers and other people in the community as well. So he just felt an overall lack of support, and he went to Baltimore County.
Dr. Greel, do you have any idea in what way he was not a good fit?
So I can't discuss individual personnel matters, but what I can say is the Gilmore community was fully engaged in this process for the new principal and chose Curtis Durham because he has the energy, he has the skill set, he has the vision to lead a unique school such as Gilmore. And he's just very excited to get started, and so we feel very confident that he'll do an excellent job as principal.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Lisa Griot, who's responsible for recruiting and keeping qualified teachers and staff at Baltimore's public schools, and with Erica Green, education reporter at the Baltimore Sun. Baltimore City school salaries are some of the highest in the state. Dr. Griot, how do you find teachers who are not just attracted to the pay scale, but who actually want to do the hard work of teaching in city schools?
The teacher candidates that come to city schools rarely list salary as a factor for wanting to come to our city and teach our students. Really, they are candidates who have a strong commitment to give back to a community that needs them. They have an understanding of the cultural needs of our students. They have strong content knowledge. And so when we ask them, well, why did you choose city schools? Salary never really comes into play. It's always about just them wanting to, having a passion for urban education and realizing that they can then show that passion, realize that passion by coming to this school district.
With the violence that students have faced in their communities over the summer, what are some of the challenges schools and teachers will face this coming year, Erica?
You know, I haven't reported much on that, but I have had, numerous conversations with teachers and school leaders that I'm in communication with. And frankly, they are just, coming back with the same resilience that they try to have, the entire year in the city. They deal with violence all the time. We did have quite a lot of students lost on the streets of Baltimore this past year. For some of our school leaders and teachers, that's not new to them. So, given that we had this momentous event, I have found that teachers and principals are really rallying around their students more than ever and really just trying to really promote the youth. I've been getting a lot more pitches for stories about students doing positive things, always against the backdrop of the ones that we've lost and the ones who were thrust into a negative light. And so I would expect that, and I hope and I look forward to hearing more from students and teachers and principals really pushing the ones who are doing the right thing and who are still with us out there for the world to see.
Dr. Griel, will there be extra programming and support for teachers working with kids who are dealing with trauma from the summer?
We're really committed to supporting our teachers. We're starting a new office. It's the Office of Organizational Development. And the goal of that office is to support all of our employees. Our emphasis this year will be on our new teachers, making sure that they have the cultural knowledge, the skill sets, they know themselves, they know their students, they know their content. And so our induction period for our new teachers is 3 years. And so during the course of those 3 years, our goal is to really give teachers the tools that they need to be successful. And that also is a retention strategy for us as a district. I think that Erica's word, the focus on resilience, is I agree with that wholeheartedly, that that's what we find, is that we do have a community here that is quite resilient. And so we just want to make sure that we are supporting, encouraging, and pouring into our teachers as much as possible.
Erica, the first day students are in the classroom is August 31st. How important is that first day in setting a tone?
You know, in the past, I've found that it is so important. As a reporter, I get excited for the first day of school every year. You know, usually the school system has a theme for the year, and so people are very much focused on that. I'm not sure what the theme is this year yet. But the first day, from the grass being manicured to a principal being in place and a teacher being in front of a classroom is incredibly important. I mean, it's been a priority for the district for years, at least since I've been on the beat for 5 years. You know, the superintendent chooses schools to go to that usually highlights some kind of theme for the year. So it's incredibly, incredibly important. And, you know, how the year starts and how the year ends is a big deal in the city.
Dr. Grillo, what is the plan to fill the eight vacancies of principals that remain?
So we are actively engaged in processes, community-based processes, for our remaining principal vacancies, excuse me. Some of those vacancies opened in July. Actually, the majority of them did. And so because the community engagement process can take some time, we wanted to make sure that we were always honoring that process. But what we have committed to as a district is to make sure that we have a principal at the head of every school on day one when students return. And so we will be moving, appointing principals over the next few weeks and making sure that they have what they need to be successful. So our goal is to have a principal in every position, in every school, by day one.
Thank you both for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Erica Green, education reporter at the Baltimore Sun, and Dr. Lisa Grillo, chief of human capital at Baltimore City Public Schools. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, comic Hurry Kondabalu. Stay with us on 88.1.
To join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Hi, everybody. Glad you're with us on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Hurry Kondabalu is a comedian of Indian descent from Brooklyn who takes on some of the biggest political and social issues of the day, including racism, colonialism, even the color of Jesus.
Why would you need to make white chocolate? Do you love the taste of chocolate, but can't stand looking at it? Well, then try some white chocolate. It's from the people that brought you white Jesus.
The New York Times has called Hurry Kondabalu one of the most exciting political comics in stand-up today. You may have caught him on Letterman, Conan, or Jimmy Kimmel. And a week from Sunday, you can catch him live at the Creative Alliance in East Baltimore. This morning, Hurry Kondabalu joins me on the line from Seattle. Welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you spend a lot of time in Seattle, I guess. You live in Brooklyn, but you're out in Seattle pretty frequently.
Yeah, it's kind of like ground zero with my jokes. I start there I started my comedy career here, so I'll still fly back to Seattle like maybe 3 or 4 times a year, rent out a 50-seat theater, do 4 shows in 2 nights, you know, start with an hour of new stuff, and by the end of it, I'll know what works. But that first show for audience members is very painful. It's me rambling and not knowing where the punchlines are, but I think people like the excitement of that. But, you know, I always end up with a bunch of new material. It's my favorite place to write and create and think freely without the pressures of New York. So it's great. I'm excited for this Baltimore show just because I've written so many new things in Seattle that, like, if people have seen me in D.C., I've never performed in Baltimore before, but if they have seen me in D.C., like, they're going to get a lot of new stuff.
Your road to comedy and your life as a stand-up comedian and writer is an interesting bit of circuitousness. It includes a stop at the London School of Economics for a master's in human rights. You grew up in Queens. I mean, how did you end up doing this? When did you start actually doing stand-up? And how does the London School of Economics fit into your grand master plan?
It definitely... Like this doing stand-up was not part of a grandmaster plan. It's something I stumbled into. I mean, I'll be clear about that. But I was 17. I always loved stand-up. And I started a comedy night in my high school, Townsend Harris High School, called Comedy Night, because I was that creative at that age. And I did my first set there, like 45 minutes of very derivative, stereotypical jokes, a lot of stuff that was also probably copied from Chris Rock and Margaret Cho with the word Indian slipped in. Like, it wasn't, like, the most creative act, but it was my first time on stage. Went to Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, and Wesleyan University for a year, and was able to really, like, develop a lot of my, like, early stuff there, learn how to perform for 45 minutes, like, really perform. But it wasn't something I thought I could do professionally, because I'd go home to New York on breaks and realize, you know what it felt like to get your butt kicked. Like, New York is a hard place to start doing stand-up. So I did it because I enjoyed it. I moved to Seattle to be an immigrant rights organizer. Like, my politics very much were influenced post 9/11. I really wanted to help, you know, the immigrant communities. And, like, I've always been a big, you know, advocate for human rights. And this was kind of like, okay, this is where I want my life to go. And there was a really good young comedy scene in Seattle at the time. So I would do comedy at night as a hobby and as relief from a really difficult job working with victims of hate crimes and people who were in immigration detention or their families who were dealing with, you know, their family members being deported or about to be deported, workplace discrimination. There was a lot of difficult stuff, and the nights would be these wonderful places to create. And somehow I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival. You know, they saw some clips of mine online. I got these auditions for this festival. I'd never submitted to anything before. I got in. I got booked to be on Jimmy Kimmel Live. I took a day off from work, flew, did the TV show, flew back to work in Seattle the next day, and people were like, were you on TV last night? Like, it was very strange because I had no plans on making this hobby a real thing. Like, it didn't seem like it was in the realm of possibility, especially as a comic who talks about race and gender and sexuality. Like, I talk about the things I'm really, you know, that I really care about that mean a lot to me, and about justice. And I ended up getting into the London School of Economics because they had a human rights master's program I really wanted. And I decided, despite the fact this career had surprisingly shown up, that I wanted to get my master's. So I did. And comedy was waiting for me. Like, I was still able to get on TV and perform in clubs. And people were interested in what I had to offer. And certainly, like, the master's degree wasn't to support the comedy career, you know. Though, you know, it's kind of funny that a human rights career and a comedy career, they're probably as lucrative, which is not lucrative at all.
Right.
So
yeah, you go for the big bucks either way. Yeah, right.
Right. Either way, money was wasted. Maybe it wasn't wasted, but it was certainly, like, I'm not using my degree in any way that LSE expected me to use it, perhaps.
On 81, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, the comedian Hari Kondabolu. He'll be performing at the Creative Alliance here in Baltimore a week from Sunday. You do mind these issues of racism and colonialism and gender and sexuality. These are not inherently funny topics. What do you think the unique capacity of comedy is to enlighten and, you know, expand people's understanding of what can often be very difficult subjects?
Well, you have a buy-in that you don't generally have when you discuss things in public without comedy, and, you know, when you have a conversation with somebody. The promise of laughter allows people to expand their attention spans more than they normally would. Certainly, people willing to open their mind because of comedy allows for thoughts to infiltrate that normally wouldn't. Even if you disagree with them, you have to deal with them. You have to deal with Like, I disagree with this person, but I'm laughing. I deal with that inconsistency. Why do I feel that way? And that's something that I think a lot of art forms cannot offer. Also, I think it's amazing because it's just a person in a microphone. You know, it's such how in a day where people can't watch more than a minute and a half of a YouTube clip without getting bored, how can human beings be able to watch an hour of a human talking with no production values? I mean, I think there's something beautiful about the fact that people still want to be connected to an individual. They still want to feel, you know, like they can relate and that they're laughing in a group. They still want that. And that allows for the comic to be able to talk about a lot of different things and have people be willing to listen.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And, of course, the key to it is that the person in the microphone have to be really compelling. You wrote in the New York Times just last month, I suppose in a way there's nothing more deadly than sort of analyzing comedy and what makes things
right. Fun. Yeah.
But this is public radio, so we have to, you know.
Right, sure.
You know, but when you wrote in the Times, you talked about silence and about the courage that it takes to be, you know, sensitive and sort of hip to the silence that you have to let happen when you're doing stand-up. It seems to me a stand-up is such a difficult thing to do and that it's so fraught with train wrecks at every turn.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about stand-up is there's something, it's like an open mic is the great equalizer. A new joke is the great equalizer. You could be a comic doing it for 20 years. When you have a new joke and you're trying it out, you're in the same position that an open micer is who has written their first joke for the first time, right? Like, you don't know where it's going to go. You're trying to make it funny. And if it doesn't work, you're desperately trying to fix it. Like, you're in the same place. I mean, how that joke develops and the skills you have are different, but at least going up there with nerves about a new idea, you know, that's the same thing. I find that really beautiful and compelling.
Yeah. I mean, are things different now at this point in your career? Number one, you've, you know, progressed and just become much more well-known and in front of the public. And also, you know, people of Asian Pacific descent have also, a lot more Asian Pacific comics and actors are on the scene. I just wonder what's different now than when you were starting, you know, back in your college days.
I mean, there's definitely a change in climate. I mean, part of the reason why I never thought this could be a career is because I didn't have any role models. You know, I loved Margaret Cho, but she stood out. Like, there weren't many people like Margaret Cho who, like, were Asian American and saying their truth and talking about their families. I mean, that was groundbreaking to me. That's the reason I wanted to do stand-up. She was the reason. But there weren't that many examples, and I didn't see any South Asians not playing stereotypical parts on television and film, and I didn't really see that many models, especially with stand-up, there, other than Russell Peters, who was, you know, Canadian, no one in America that really showed me it was a feasible thing. But now you watch TV and you see South Asian anchors, you see actors, you see comedians, you know that you're not alone. There's been a sea change, and I feel it. I mean, that certainly gives me more confidence, first of all. And also, I remember going on stage, even in those early days in Seattle, a very progressive city, and you could sense audiences being confused that I wasn't addressing race early. Why aren't you addressing the fact you're Indian? How come you sound this way? What are you talking? Like, I didn't fit whatever perception they had of Indian people or Indian Americans. And, you know,
yeah,
it's
an a priori assumption that you're going to talk about that because that's all
right
they've
off the
ever
bat.
Heard anybody talk about. Yeah.
Right. You know, or the fact that I'm political. Maybe my influences are people like Paul Mooney and Pryor and Rock, who have a strong voice and who can show rage on stage and still be funny. Like, that's not what they expected. And I think now, I mean, it's still not universal, but now there's more examples of South Asians in the media. So I think the novelty of seeing me just as a figure on stage has not completely disappeared, but it's certainly dissipated. So you can see me and your first shock is your first thought isn't like, what is this? People at least will be like, oh yeah, this is a South Asian person. That's interesting. I wonder what he has to say versus like, this is weird. What is he doing up there? You know, and that's a major change. That's a huge change. And I feel more comfortable getting on stage and saying whatever I want. Part of that is also confidence. I've been doing this for 15 years, but also knowing that like there's less of a freak show element and that there's a lot of people who are going to see me in particular because they've seen my work on the internet, because they've seen me on television. So there's a confidence in knowing there's going to be some people at least that like know what they're getting themselves into.
Sure. I'm interested that guys like Jerry Seinfeld, among others, who's of course older, he's white, he's been in the business a long, long time, but he's complained that audiences in a way are becoming too politically correct. He says it's harder now for comedians to make jokes because people are, you know, sort of more conscious about what's being, what's considered offensive. What's your take on that perspective?
I think that makes him sound ancient. I mean, if you, like that, even when people say things are politically correct, I mean, people have rationale and reasons why they feel the way they feel. It dismisses what those reasons are. Like, progress is never easy, and we're living in a time where there's so much progress very quickly, you know, whether it's the gay rights movement, the transgender movement, what we've seen with Black Lives Matter. You know, there was a time in this country when you could say whatever you wanted to say, right? And anything went. And part of the reason for that is because a lot of people of color and queer folks and women were excluded, right? They didn't have a chance to have their voice heard. They weren't in the workplace. You can make whatever off-color jokes you wanted. You could say whatever you wanted because there was no one to disagree. There was no one to influence the conversation in any other way, or at least not, no one with power. And now all of a sudden you have people seeping into the media who are people of color, who are queer folks. The internet allows for a certain equality that wasn't there before. So it's changed. So the exciting thing is, how do you address a different situation? Like, your responsibility as a comic is to address what's happening in society, what's happening in a room, to notice the sea change that is happening in society, you know, within society. Like, if by saying things are politically correct, what you're doing is you're dismissing what's in front of you. You're not addressing what's in front of you. You're just using a term to just like pretend it's not there. I think offense is an easy word. Sometimes it's not offense. People are logical in that I disagree with this. I think that's wrong. I'm not offended by it. I know why I think it's wrong. Do you know what I mean? When I hear a racist joke, I'm not offended. I'm like, that's racist.
Yeah.
That's wrong. That's a wrong thing. That is incorrect. That information is wrong. You're spreading lies. It's incorrect. And the incorrectness of it, not the politically incorrect, the actual incorrectness of the statement is too strong for me to forgive it in order to laugh. You know, that's part of it. So I think that it fundamentally ignores your job as a comedian to say things are politically correct and then just dismiss an audience. So your job is to figure it out. I have to figure it out. Everybody has to figure out what's happening in a crowd at a particular time.
And for those crowds, I think the term of art that comedians use is punching up. You tend to punch up, making jokes about people sort of at the top of the rung of, you know, power and celebrity and notoriety, rather than, you know, mock the people on the lower rungs. That's a conscious decision. That's a conscious approach.
Yeah, I mean, that's who I am. You know, like I, the same thing. I think I suppose that drew me to immigrant rights organizing. You know, when I was in my early 20s, it's the same values. Like, I go after the people I feel like are doing the oppressing or who have privilege. You know, that's where the harder targets are. Do you know what I mean? You're making fun of homeless people. I've heard enough jokes about homeless people. I've heard enough jokes about minorities. You know, it's not to say that I'm punching up because it's a new creative angle. I'm doing it because it's like what I feel. And also as an artist, it is more challenging, to be perfectly honest. Like, it's harder to hit angles and make people uncomfortable. And if you can play with discomfort and still make people laugh, I mean, the laughs are, to me, even more valuable. It's like I was able to bring you to a place you did not want to go, and yet you still laughed at the end. I think that's an accomplishment. And to me, that's in addition to what I think is just, I also think that's a bigger artistic achievement.
Comedian Hari Kondabolu will do two shows at the Creative Alliance a week from Sunday, August 23rd. The 7 o'clock show is sold out. There are still tickets remaining for the 9:30 show, but the folks at Creative Alliance tell us they're going fast. Hari Kondabolu will be joined on that bill by Liz Mealy and local comedian Umar Khan. His debut stand-up album is called Waiting for 2042. We've got links to more information on our website. Come on over to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. Baltimore City Health Commissioner Lena Wen recently said that Baltimore is a city that is, quote, overwhelmed with the population of animals. Perhaps no one in Baltimore knows this better than Jennifer Brouse, the executive director of the Baltimore Animal Rescue and Care Shelter, or BARCS. Brouse, her 57 employees, and 400-plus volunteers take in about 12,000 animals every year. And if that number isn't startling enough, this year, BARCS has neutered nearly 1,700 feral cats and returned them to where they were picked up as part of a trap-neuter release program. In the first 10 days of this month alone, BARCS has taken in more than 100 cats, cats that are now available for adoption. Jennifer Brouse is here to tell us more. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
So cats generally breed between March and September, so I guess we're kind of approaching the end of cat breeding season, or are we just in the middle?
You know, it is kind of approaching the end when you look at what it should be. But really, in Maryland, because it's been so warm, we have breeding season all year long. We've been kind of thankful for the last two winters because that's helped. But we see kittens throughout the year.
Have you been seeing an uptick in recent months?
Yes, actually we have. August was pretty high in the number of kittens we had coming into the shelter. But overall, compared to the last couple of years, due to our new TNR program, we've seen a lot less kittens.
And possibly the cold winters that have helped stop a little bit of breeding.
Absolutely.
About how many cats are you capable of sheltering at BARCS at any one time?
We have about 150 cages, and if they come in with a litter, we'll put them together. So we can house probably close to 200 cats at any given time.
But of course, you can't take in every cat that comes in. What are the reasons that you might have to turn some cats away?
Well, we are an open admission shelter, which means we do accept every animal that's brought to our shelter. Yeah.
But they can't all go up for adoption.
They can't all go up for adoption, absolutely. So when people bring an animal to us, there's a couple of things. First of all, if they're surrendering their pet, we first see what we can do to might be able to help them to keep their pet. And then if there's no option for them to keep it, we will take that animal in and do our best to put it up for adoption, depending on what the issues are or what our space is like at the shelter. And then if an animal comes in as a stray cat, we will talk to that person and ask them, first of all, could they help post for it being a lost cat somewhere in the area that they found it? We are asked if they're interested in keeping it to help us with space, or we see if it's a candidate for our TNR program.
And I assume you have some foster programs as well.
We do. We have about 400 animals at any given time in foster homes. In the spring and summer, it can get up to 800 with the number of cats that we see. So we also will try to get as many out into foster homes as possible.
We've mentioned pet cats and feral cats. It's not like there's any genetic difference between the two. But if kittens are born to feral cats and they're not socialized or introduced to humans early enough, they're probably not ever going to be a real indoor pet cat, are they?
They probably aren't. It depends on how early you can catch them, because you can help a cat to become more, even an adult cat, to become more acclimated to people. We don't always know their history, so they might seem feral at first, but after they're around people for a while, they can become acclimated. So we have a lot of caregivers out that their outdoor cats will come over to them because they're comfortable with that person, but maybe not anybody else. And so for kittens, it just all depends on when you catch them and then also on their individual personality.
And even domestic cats don't necessarily like people.
Other
than the people they know. I mentioned one of the things that you've been doing to try to cut down Baltimore's feral cat populations, the Trap Neuter Release Program. When did that start here in Baltimore?
We started it at BARCS at the high volume that we're doing now in 2013, but there have been other groups and individuals who've been doing it for decades.
How does it work?
So basically, for us, when we get a complaint or when animal control will get a complaint, they'll notify us if there's a lot of outdoor cats in an area, or if people who are just need additional help that they have a lot of cats, they'll notify us. And so we have a team of two people who go out and trap in those areas. They bring the cats into BARCS. And then from there, we either do spay and neuter at our facility or we send them to one of our rescue vet partners to do spay and neuter. And then we also vaccinate the animals with both rabies and distemper. We do flea treatment and anything else that they might need. And as long as they're in healthy condition, then they get returned to where they were originally found.
And why is that important?
It's important. Which part? It's all important.
It's all important. But yeah. Returning them. I mean, some places people try to take the cats off the street. But the TNR program is specifically designed to return as many cats to where they came from as possible.
Absolutely. So there's many benefits to it. First of all, these animals are being cared for by someone out in the community. so they're their pets. They consider them their pets or animals that they've fallen in love with. They're feeding them and caring for them, which is why they're thriving where they are located outside. We don't return animals that aren't in good condition, that don't have a caregiver, that aren't thriving. And we're not putting any new animals out there. These are animals that have already been living out there. So the benefit to us directly and to shelters across the nation that do this program is there's less animals coming into the shelter. So that's saving taxpayer money. It's saving the shelter from having to kill animals because we're inundated with cats. It's what we take in the most.
And you've been doing a lot to lower your euthanization rates.
We have. We started all kinds of programs over the past 10 years to work on lowering euthanasia rates. And this is another one that we've seen tremendous results from.
Do you have any idea of how many cats have gone through TNR programs since you've started it?
For our specific program, we've spayed and neutered over 7,000 animals in the 2 years that we've been running the program. And every year, our goal is at least 3,500. So we're right on mark.
What does that translate to? Any idea of how many kittens aren't born because of this program?
Thousands and thousands.
Because how many times do cats breed a year?
They can get pregnant at early as 4 months of age, and their pregnancy or gestation is about 2 months, and they go into heat every 2 to 3 weeks, so they can breed quite a bit. And spring through the fall is when typical breeding season is, so they can have multiple litters in that time, and an average litter is about 5 kittens. So if you think of that number, and we've altered over 7,000 animals, that's quite a few less kittens that are born into our community.
What are the benefits of keeping the cat population down in Baltimore, the outdoor cat population? I know in Australia they're trying to cull the cat population, but then there was never anything like a cat in the Australian ecosystem until they were introduced, and they've caused extinction of creatures there. Not as bad in Baltimore, but of course you still want to keep those populations low.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, when the population can become so out of hand, and it has. I mean, there are a lot of people who are spending all the money they have and trying to find resources they have to care for these cats because their colonies are just getting larger and larger. So we're helping community members to be able to control the situation that they have been very compassionate about trying to control themselves without resources. So we're helping people to take care of their colonies in a much healthier way. And the population could get out of hand because of how much they can have litters and how often that they can breed. And so we want to help curtail that population. In addition, we're also vaccinating with rabies. So we're helping to at least get a barrier of rabies protection out there.
If someone wants a cat from Barks, not a feral one, obviously, one who would be a good pet, what do they have to do?
So if they want to adopt a cat, they can come down to the shelter. We're at 301 Stockholm Street. So they can come down and look at the 150 that we have down there. And then also they can go on our website and look at the various cats we have there, because we have, like I said, hundreds out in foster homes. And then we also have a few, we have partnerships with a couple local pet stores to where we have some cats up for adoption in their stores as well.
Jennifer Brouse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Brouse is the executive director of the Baltimore Animal Rescue and Care Shelter, or BARCS. More about everything BARCS does is available online, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1776, the 9th Maryland Convention met in Annapolis. By October, the 76 delegates had hammered out a Declaration of Rights and a state constitution, much of which is still reflected in today's state constitution. Enjoy your weekend. Be back with us Monday.